Whole Package Cash, a semi-monthly news and discussion show about the world of DB2. Thanks for joining us again for the only podcast that knows the recursive SQL necessary to win Warren Buffett's billion-dollar NCAA bracket challenge. Today is March 9, 2014, and this is episode number 12. This show is hosted by me, Ian Bjorhovda, and my co-host, Fred Sobotka.
Good morning.
How's it going, Fred?
Not bad, man. It's it warmed up in Chicago a little bit late at night, and I just could not resist walking around in something above freezing. So that was a slice of heaven that I got to enjoy at about midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. So, but it's back to sub-freezing temperatures again. So it was fun while it lasted.
Yeah, I saw something come in the news this week that the Great Lakes have the most ice freeze, I don't know, in some time, or maybe it's a record. I don't know.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. It's pretty horrible.
Well, I guess we got to have some entertainment from Donald Trump.
Really?
So, what have you been up to?
Well, been moving along with some upgrades and looking at Blue a bit more. Had some good upgrades from 9.7 to 10.5 in Windows that needed no special adjustment at all. So those were due to Melanie Stouffer's great presentation slides on all the different ways you can upgrade to 10.5 and what you should prepare for. So anyone out there who's thinking of taking the plunge should definitely look at that first, see. But yeah, it just installed right over the old one. And this was a Express C install. So Express C typically has the reputation of not being something you can easily upgrade because you need to buy the fixed term license upgrade for that. But this just slid right in. So it was really nice. I was wondering what to do with the extra time.
Well, that's good. I still don't have anyone who's been looking at going to 10.5 immediately yet. Some messing around, but no actual upgrades.
Not even with the 10.5.3 update that just finally came out after a bit of teasing earlier in the year?
Man, what the with that?
Yeah. We've been getting these ticklers about 10.5.3, since December at least, right?
Yeah, I think it was December 19th, the word kind of went out on the wire that it was imminent.
Which was crazy because Fix Pack 2 had just come out with some fixes for DB211 connectivity on the mainframe side. So it wasn't like people were expecting a fix that quickly, and it was just suddenly announced, and another DB2 friend of ours, DB2 Dean, picked it up at one point and announced it like it was ready. So he fell for it too. So I wasn't so embarrassed.
Yeah, but then IBM put out that note saying, "Oops, we said we were releasing 10.5 Fix Pack 3, but it's not ready yet."
But now it's ready, and I've applied it. How about you?
No, I haven't.
It's good.
I'm a little afraid to. I downloaded when it finally came out, and I think that was February 18th or something, or 20th. Oh, yeah, it was February 18th. So I downloaded it, and I untarred the Linux fix pack, and the code level that came in that fix pack had a December build date.
Right.
And I looked at that and said, okay, this is crazy. And lo and behold, 2 days later, I get an email that looks like it was broadcast out to anyone who had downloaded fix packs between December 18th and 20th, saying, "You look like you downloaded it. We discovered some bugs in our build process, so please go and re-download it."
Yeah, I get a lot of emails from IBM, all like subscriptions and such, so I'm sure that was one of them. I noticed that there were two code levels shown on the download site when I was looking at it, so I naturally picked the newer one, and that turned out to be the right move, because after the round of explanations went out, I ended up not needing to download anything different. So it applied well on Windows 7, but my Windows 8.1 environment was a little odd. The installer would not shut down any of the existing services. So I don't know if that's something that is just specific to my weird environment or if it's just not handled on Windows 8.1 the same way.
Well, is that something where if you just shut down the services, like you went into services control panel and stopped everything, then it would install okay? Or
yeah, not just the DB2 stuff, but remember in 10.5 they put in that SSH server, which I've actually messed around with a little bit. And
yeah, that's in 10.1 too.
Okay, yeah, right. I didn't do much with 10.1 on Windows, so I've been going from 9.7 to 10.5, and I had to shut that thing down. For FixPack 3 to install. So it was to take it from 10.5.2 to 10.5.3. So that was a little odd. Didn't have to do that on Windows 7. So I don't know. Maybe I got to reinstall Windows 8.1. Who knows?
Do you use that SSH daemon? I found it actually kind of fun because I could now SSH into a Windows server.
Exactly. It doesn't really put you into anything that's DB2 specific. It seems like it just drops you down into CMD or something or whatever you want to do. In the SSH command, you can say which command you want it to run as part of your sign-on. And I was getting different commands running over that SSH server. So for better or worse, it's pretty cool. It's definitely convenient, and I can see it being a worthwhile replacement for the DB2 admin server or the DAS. But I could also see there being some security concerns. You know, when you've got your network security guys suddenly hearing that, oh, your production Windows database server is now hosting an SSH server, they might be interested to hear a couple things about what it's doing and how they can secure it.
Yeah, it's pretty handy. I mean, I was able to SSH in, and when I SSH in, I tell it to start a DB2 command window, which would initialize the environment. So I can run commands, but it's still pretty limited, right? I mean, it's definitely not a bash shell or K shell.
Right.
So you have to be careful, otherwise you accidentally, log out.
Right. Yeah, I've been using PLink, which is part of the PuTTY suite for Windows. PLink lets you specify a single command that runs. It's not meant to maintain an interactive login.
Oh, so you weren't using PuTTY to?
I wasn't PuTTYing into the server. I was just using PLink to run like a single command, like just to see if I could find stuff out. But and that's, I think it's more useful than having an interactive session. That when you're scripting and you've got a bunch of different DB2 Windows servers out there, this can get a single thing from each one.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I had played around a little bit with it to see about messing with the configuration of it in order to, only allow certain keys, certain SSH keys, because by default, when you SSH, it just gives you a username and password prompt.
Right.
Which, of course, if your Windows box is in a domain, it's just you're putting in a domain user and password. And I typically like to, especially for automated stuff like what you were talking about, I like to use a public key to be able to log in without a password.
Right.
But in my limited fooling around, I wasn't particularly successful in getting the IBM SSH server to accept public keys or couldn't figure out quite where to put those public keys because even though it's running open SSH,
right,
the location of the files that it uses are in like that application support directory or something, and it's, I don't know, something is weird with it.
Yeah, you caught that too. I saw the open SSH remnants as part of that, so that made me wonder whenever the IBM doc is not clear on something that it repackages, gives me an idea of where I could go looking for more details, such as when I was trying to debug InfiniBand connectivity issues on PureScale for 9.8, I ended up looking at other implementations that use that same library because I just couldn't find the information on the InfoCenter.
Interesting. Well, I think that whole SSH client was bundled because of Data Studio, right? I mean, obviously losing the DAS necessitated some kind of alternate solution, but I don't know. Having a SSH server running and having Data Studio go and kick off SSH sessions to do things, I don't know. That makes me feel a little weird.
I like the pattern in theory, but when you start throwing SSH servers into things, someone other than the DBA is generally going to need to weigh in on how all that's done. So only if it's as configurable as OpenSSH daemons on Linux and Unix is it really going to be something that a shop is going to embrace. I mean, it's tremendously useful from a Windows perspective because it adds features that really weren't there before, but it's got to be a full offering. I don't know if that means they need the full OpenSSH server, but they at least need to give those pesky network admins and the network security folks the controls they need to get it working properly and securely.
Yeah, and documentation seems extremely light on what you can do.
Yeah, I was really working under the assumption that they weren't interested in opening that up very much and making it limited just to the database administration parts of Data Studio, which seems like it might be more justified in being so light on details. But when you throw an SSH server out there, it's not that reasonable to assume that no one else is going to want to do anything with it.
Right. No, that's agreed. So, let's see. Elsewhere in the news, DB2's Got Talent Season 4 is plugging along.
How's that going?
Well, I threw my hat into the ring. I was a late entrant into the games.
Now, did you plan to enter this?
Not really.
So, you it was more like an accident then?
Yeah, I came in and put together a presentation for the last of the contestant search shows and was a little surprised when the judges selected me to move on. So now I'm in the finals.
Well, congratulations. I think the key is to not think about it too much. You just kind of got the presentation together, took some stuff you knew and thought you'd share it, and then suddenly you're in a contest.
Well, one thing's for sure. The quality of the presentations this year is extremely high. I mean, looking at past seasons of DB2's Got Talent, and you have a pretty wide mix. But this year, I mean, the top 10, the first top 10 finals, which was on Friday the 7th of March, a couple of days ago from when we were recording. I mean, I would have a hard time choosing among those presentations because everyone is totally polished and the presentations are really good. So it's pretty awesome. Scott has really developed a pretty amazing little factory for getting people to develop presenting skills.
Well, that's good to hear. And those shows you can pull down any time after they air. You don't actually have to be there for the live recording because I'm usually either on a plane or wrapping up a week at a customer site when it airs live on Friday mornings, but I'm interested in hearing those presentations.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot to learn. So you can go to the db2nightshow.com and find the DB2's Got Talent. We'll put a link to it in the show notes so you can download and check those out. And of course, if you are interested, you could always vote for me.
I'll do that 3 or 4 times at least. That's going to be great.
Well, thank you. One thing I'll have to say is doing a 4-minute presentation is extremely challenging. I don't think I realized it as much before as I do now, but trying to fit a topic and not get ducked by Scott's famous, I don't know what's making that quacking, but whatever it is a lot harder than it looks.
I think it's one of his Oracle test machines for his DBI software. He's got wired up to that duck call generator.
So the duck is the duck happens when the Oracle server is crashing.
Yeah, that 4 minute limit though, that's a real challenge. And in Portland, we had that a wave of that with Pecha Kucha when it first came out, the abbreviated presentation format. And I guess it was designed by an architecture firm that was tired of having architects ramble on at length about their different ideas. So they did a thing where the slides would just advance. You had a limited number of slides and a set number of seconds for each slide, uniform, and there was no way to elaborate on anything. And then something similar for the Ignite format, which I think went further and spread wider than Pecha Kucha. And those still go on, I think, as a monthly thing. But yeah, those lightning talks can be really captivating, and especially with the slides not having to really be the notes for the whole session like they typically are at IDUG and sometimes IOD. I think it can be liberating too, as well as intimidating to get everything packed into such a small window of time.
I've always wondered if it would be interesting too for IDUG to have a similar kind of thing. I mean, I think having an entire track dedicated to short, yeah, say like 20-minute presentations, you know, or even 15 minutes. So you could have 3 15-minute presentations in a one-hour slot. I've always thought it might be interesting for them to do that, and maybe you might be able to get more people who would be willing to speak.
Yeah, there's a lot of time to fill at IDUG, but the thing that I walked away with having volunteered on it for the years that I did was there's already a lot going on there. And it's rough to be a conference committee volunteer, and they get a lot of abstracts to go through, and then a lot to winnow down, and then a lot of presentations to wrangle from the speakers in the weeks leading up to the conference. So it have to be awfully easy to add that on to their responsibilities.
Yeah, if Bob Varga was listening to this, he would be sending daggers into his
Yeah, he's going to have your auto insurance canceled.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it have to be handled a certain way. They also have the special interest groups, which maybe the SIGs could be something that are arranged that way, where a block of the SIG is just kind of a rotating thing.
Yeah.
But the real challenge at IDUG and IOD is that there's so much going on at any one time, you're already missing out on stuff. And at least with the traditional 60-minute or two-hour presentations, you at least have the slides for the sessions you can't see. So to throw these things up, I can see it being really challenging.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'll try it with my local rug.
Yeah. Yeah. Local rugs, that would be tremendous, because when dealing with the rug I ran for a while trying to revive, is people might want to present for a few minutes, but not a whole hour.
Yeah.
There's a lot of users out there with stuff they can share, but that would work really well. It'd work really well, I think, for the rugs.
The hour-long presentations for the conferences, it's a lot of work to put one of those together. I mean, hours and hours of work. And the four-minute DB2's Got Talent format is, again, way more work than I would have expected in order to do it. So it seems like maybe a 15-minute presentation, I mean, obviously it's always going to be a lot of work, but I spend a lot of time having to just cut stuff down to get into 4 minutes. And maybe at 15 minutes, it's long enough that you aren't necessarily rushed, but it's not so long that you're really having to prepare tons and tons of content to fill up that hour.
I think the 4 minute thing has value, even as short as that is, just because there's aspects of the product that maybe you don't get around to, and 4 minutes is enough time for someone to step in and say, let me give you a rough guide to, let's say, workload management or those column hiding voodoo security routines, things that you might not normally get into.
Yeah, Mike Krafik, who is an awesome DBA from Atlanta, he gave a presentation on column masking. And that's a topic that Waleed, the security guy from Toronto, who he presented that in an hour. And Mike was able to just talk about column masking and build a completely awesome presentation in 4 minutes on giving you the basics of how to set up column masking.
That's almost intimidating.
It is. All right. So what's next?
Well, you also mentioned that DB2 best practices wiki.
Right. They've moved the best practices from only PDFs that were occasionally updated to now they've gone to a wiki, which seems to be interesting because they can keep them more up to date. But since they've done that, they've still managed to release a bunch of best practices documents, some of which are still available in PDF and some of which aren't.
Yeah, that's rough. I'd agree that the PDFs are a much more attractive medium. I have no problem pointing my customers to the PDF best practices, which is how they started out. But pointing them to a wiki, yeah, I'm not so sure. I just don't see that as being something that is going to be kept up or might be just too chaotic and not as portable as a portable document.
Yeah, I like the PDFs because I just stick a copy of them in my Dropbox. So if I need them for quick reference, I can just pull it up on, you know, my computer or phone or whatever. Yeah.
Google's going to see into both of those formats pretty well, but when it comes time to actually hand something to somebody, I'd much rather hand them the PDF as of a certain build date of that document than some wiki. It just is based on the people you're dealing with.
So let's see, what else is going on? Looks like the IBM Knowledge Center that I am such a massive fan of is out of beta. Maybe. I don't know. It's in the process. The word has gone out on the street that it's going to replace the information centers.
Yeah, you got to sign in and you got to tell, but you can tell it which products you care about. So you don't keep hearing about these silly MDX cubes when you're searching for DB2 command syntax. So that alone, I think, might make it really compelling alternative. I also wonder if they've reworked much of the content over the information center. Every now and then I run into parts of the information center that just are blatantly cut and pasted from previous versions. Sometimes they don't even bother to change the version number. Nice. So I generally send out an email when I spot those, but perhaps the Knowledge Center is different enough to be a reworking and provide the opportunity for them to clean that up.
Well, it definitely seems like it's getting love. I mean, there's a lot of traffic on DB2L, which is mostly mainframe, but I actually emailed a couple of developers with some problems, and they were extremely responsive, and so it seems like this is a pretty high-end project. I mean, it must be going out across IBM as a whole, not just information management, it seems.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll change my bookmarks.
Yeah, I did that. I used to keep a couple bookmarks for the different versions of DB2, and now they're all gone and just the Knowledge Center.
It's the end of an era.
Yeah. Yeah, I got a tweet from some guy whose username was Max Webster, which that was an old Canadian prog rock band from the 70s. But he was talking about how the Information Center has been around for 18 years and its original incantation was a C++ application running on OS2.
Sweet. I must have walked right past that when I was at the Computer History Museum last month.
So let's see. So there was a big conference, IBM Pulse, which I don't even know what that conference is, but man, there sure was a lot of chatter about it.
There was a lot going on at Pulse, and we don't normally do the Pulse conference because it's not exclusively about data the way IOD is, and it's not crammed up against other conferences we go to. It's kind of evenly spaced out, which takes away the fun.
But looks like those kids were having a fun time anyway with the big announcements that were going on out there.
Yeah, having Susan Visser being so involved in the marketing side now, I was seeing a lot of stuff coming through Twitter, and it seemed like there was a whole lot of DB2-related stuff going on.
Yeah. So it's nice that we've got a person inside that whole apparatus, because otherwise it could be about a bunch of other things that really wouldn't pop up on our radar. But with Susan as kind of the human interface to that whole event, I think it's been nice to see what bubbles up to the top through the DB2 marketing side, and definitely Blue Acceleration is one of them. But they also went on another shopping spree, and then they launched another site. So I thought that it was pretty neat to see them buying yet another. Well, not another, but they bought Cloudant, which is very similar in a lot of ways to MongoDB, which they've been trying very hard to replace in shops. So maybe now DB2 as a front end to MongoDB isn't as important if they can get you on a Cloudant database instead and integrate that somehow. So that was a billion plus for that.
Yeah. I saw that analyst Kurt Monash raised an interesting question a few weeks ago about how many billion-dollar acquisitions has IBM had. And actually, that piqued my interest. So I went back and looked at it, something like 4 or 5 in the last 6 months.
Wow. And this last one, Cloudant, they really weren't shipping much of a product, as it were, until just a little over 3 years ago. So they went from no customers to a couple of thousand Cloudant customers based on CouchDB to being bought by IBM. So good for them.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting, because Bluemix was another announcement that came out of Pulse. And it seems like between Bluemix, Cloudant, and the SoftLayer stuff, it seems like IBM is trying to build up a whole competitor to Amazon Web Services, right? So not just EC2, but that whole world of stuff that Amazon offers.
Definitely. So they had their pedigree for Bluemix in the Cloud Foundry stuff and the open cloud architecture. And so the predecessor to Bluemix actually still has a thing that says, now an IBM product, and this technology is no longer under active development, which is the kind of a JSTART page. And now it's just Bluemix as a, I guess, open beta. So they're definitely looking to smush all of these cloud hexagons together, as you can tell from the new Bluemix landing page. It looks like a really cool video game, and I wanna buy the app, and I wanna start playing it.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how Blue for Cloud plays out, because it seems like that is just a component of Bluemix and all of this.
Right. So they've got it sitting right next to MapReduce and in the big data layer of this pyramid. So you could theoretically smush in a Blue Acceleration, which would almost certainly be Blue for Cloud, because they're already running it as a cloud demo.
Right.
And it's decent. I've played around on the box, and it's pretty beefy even for the beta. So I can see them being pretty aggressive and getting the Blue Acceleration part of the cloud for this Bluemix to be reasonably unencumbered and well provisioned. So yeah, it seems like they've got a lot of pieces that can fit together for this. They're throwing in other stuff too, like Redis, RabbitMQ, Twilio, whatever that is. Good stuff all around. Lots of little hexagons ready to be snapped together to do your bidding. The question is, are you in a spot in your project where you can make the best use of all that? Or are you sitting on a project, like a predecessor project, that's not quite geared up for this type of architecture, and you've got a lot of stuff in-house that you want to fold in? How versatile are these hexagons when you've got a bunch of things that you want to reuse?
Yeah, there was a post from someone named Rakesh Ranjan, who wrote the Data Scientist's Guide to IBM Bluemix, where he described kind of the thought process between who would use this and how they would use it. And it seemed a little far-fetched.
Contrived?
Yeah, a little bit. Just, you know, he just lays out the case of this imaginary person who wants to build some application, and just sticking these hexagons available in Bluemix together is able to throw something together in a day or two.
Right.
And so it seems like it's a lot of smoothing over of the integration side of it.
Definitely applicable for prototyping, but how far beyond that is the current model of Bluemix really going to remain relevant? And what's the crossover look like? Because, well, let's say the intrepid experimenter, big idea person is able to snap these hexagons together. And I did count the sides to make sure they're hexagons. And then what? Is it going to be deployed? What are the deployment options at that point? Because a company may not want to deploy onto the collection of things that this eager explorer snapped together for a variety of reasons. They may not want to do that. So what happens then after the prototype? And it's not necessarily, this isn't necessarily a failing of Bluemix. It's just the reality of prototyping applications.
Yeah. Well, it remains to be seen what is going to happen in that. I mean, it's all very new. And when you have a product that's called, I think it's called Codename Bluemix, not just Bluemix.
Right.
It will be interesting to see where this goes.
Well, at the very least, I'll sniff around the blue acceleration part of it, because I think it's really attractive to get that spun up for people, just to kind of show them the options for what blue acceleration will do to your scan performance and the amount of data you can bearably paw through without lots of optimized indexes and such.
All right. So you've got something going on with iDug next month, right?
Yeah, this is my first month curating any content for iDug, and I'll be putting together the topic of the month, which for April is indexing.
Right.
So hopefully there'll be a few people out there. Now, I've got some heavy hitters lined up to share their indexing wisdom from the trenches, but I could always use some more. I want to really show everyone that I can run this thing. So I'm putting the call out for any indexing related topics you might have. And I reconsidered. A lot of people really complained about this. I will take papers from IBMers. So if anyone in the lab wants to write for iDug about indexing for DB2LUW or on Z, I'll be happy to talk to you and get your content published and advertised through iDug's massive online marketing machine. So please hit me up on Twitter or through iDug, and we'll get your indexing topics published for the month.
All right. You got to move pretty quick on that, though.
April's going to be a big month. It's going to also be the last month of content before we slide into the North American User Group Conference for iDug in May in Phoenix, where you'll be brewing espresso in the parking lot using nothing but the sun, right?
Yeah, they have sun tea, but I'm going to make sun espresso.
That'd be excellent.
All right. Well, I think that covers us for today. You can find me on Twitter. I am IDBJORH. Fred, you are DB2Fred.
Yep.
If you enjoyed the episode, please rate us or leave feedback in iTunes. The show notes, along with links to everything we talked about in this episode, are available at packagecash.com/12. And you can also find there a link to contact us, our tweet handles again, or you can subscribe to the show. We'll look forward to talking to you next time.
Good night, everybody.
All right.
Well, that'll be great because we started the thing off by saying good morning, everybody.
Did we really?
Yep, sure.
Awesome.